Tonight, as we continue our study of unlikely heroes, we come tonight to study Esther. Queen Esther. The title of our study tonight is Esther for Such a Time as This. Open your Bibles with me, please, to the first chapter of the book of Esther. And tonight, around 45 minutes, we're going to try to cover this entire book. You might say, is that even possible for you to do? Well, we're going to try this evening. That means we'll just have to hit the high points here tonight. And so that's always hard because there's a lot of good nuggets in this book. And I pray that we would be encouraged this evening. As we think about Esther, a Jewish orphan who by God's providence was elevated to become queen the Persian Empire, and would be used to deliver her people. Now, just to kind of set the scene for us here, what's going on. The book of Esther, we do not know who wrote this book. Though it bears her name, she is not the author. It is possible that it was written by someone like Ezra or Nehemiah or someone else during that time. It is during the days of when the Persian Empire was the dominant global force at the time. The setting for the book of Esther is during the days when battles were great between Persia and Greece. The first king that was really involved in these battles between the Persians and the Greek was Darius I, but he did not experience victory but defeat, including the famous historical defeat at the battle at Marathon. His son, Xerxes I, would have to first quell rebellions in his empire of the Babylonians and the Egyptians, and then he turned his sight once again on the Greeks. And while he would sack the important Greek city of Athens, eventually he would be forced out. And if you have ever seen the movie 300, the historical occasions of that movie take place during the reign of Xerxes. Well, Xerxes I is in the book of Esther, but he goes by a different name. Ahasuerus is how he is called here in the book of Esther. And in verse number 1 of Esther chapter 1, you will see the description of the Persian Empire and his might all the way from India, close to the present-day Pakistan, all the way to Ethiopia and south into Sudan and into modern-day Libya. So all of that was under the might of the Persian Empire. And in the book of Esther, we're going to see unfold before us an amazing portrait of the providence and the sovereignty of God. And yet the book of Esther is one of two books in the Bible that does not have the name God or Lord in it. Yet, though, he is the main character in this book. So that's just a quick overview of what's happening. Let's dive in. So let's start in chapter number 1. And this scene for us, our first scene tonight, is removing a queen. Removing a queen. The setting here in chapter 1 is that the king in verse number 5 has gathered all of his men, his officers, his nobles, there in the capital city of Susa to have a great feast. We're told in verse number 5 that it lasted for 7 days. Verse 6, it says there were white cotton curtains and violet hangings fastened with cords and fine linen and purple to silver rods and marble pillars, couches of gold and silver. Verse 7, drinks were served in golden vessels, vessels of different kinds, and the royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king. And so this is a high old time. They've got the spread here. They've got everything that's wonderful, that's nice. And as you can imagine, 7 days of this banquet and 7 days of drinking, and these people are absolutely drunk. I mean, they are totally smashed here. And it says in verse 10 and following that the king decided after 7 days that he wants to bring his queen out and verse 11 to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was lovely to look at. So he has decided that he kind of wants to bring out his queen in front of all of these men and show her off. But we're told in verse 12 that she refused at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. At this, the king became enraged, and his anger burned within him. Now, if you continue to read on, he was afraid that if he did not act against her, in verse 17, that she would become an example, and all the women in the royal house would begin to disregard what their husbands and the leaders said. So he decides that he's going to have to put her to the side. Now, King Ahasuerus had quite a temper and was in many ways an irrational man when he was mad. History records that during their battles with the Greeks, that when he had his engineers construct a bridge passageway for them to go over, that after his engineers had built this, that a great storm came through and destroyed the structure. Well, the king was upset. He was very mad. He first of all had all the engineers beheaded because he believed that meant that they didn't know what they were doing and they had made a weak vessel to go over. Then, now here's where it gets very interesting, and we see that this man has some issues. He commanded his soldiers to rebuke the waters. And so he sent them into the waters with whips and commanded them to beat and lash 300 times the waters. But that is not all. Then to throw shackles into the waters that mean to bound them. And then to take and stab the waves with a red-hot branding iron. So yes, this man has some issues. And so, in his anger, because of his queen's refusal to obey him, he puts her to the side, and she is no longer queen. Which brings us to chapter 2 into the second scene, and that is selecting Esther. Now, in verse number 1, it says, "After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's young men who attended him said, 'Let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king. And let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa the capital, under custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women. Let their cosmetics be given them. And let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti.' This pleased the king, and he did so." Now, there has been years that have passed here since he had removed Vashti and this occasion. This was when the battles had taken place with the Greeks. He's come back. He's defeated. And so he comes back to his capital, and he needs, for lack of a better term, a distraction. He needs something to occupy his time that will bring him pleasure. And so he remembers about he needs a queen. And so he decides that they're going to have a beauty pageant here. That's what this was. This was going to be a beauty pageant, and they were going to find the virgin that would please the king. And so now we see here is where the hand of God begins to move. He has come back after no success. He's failed in battle. That's not a coincidence. To get him back into the capital, and now to look for a queen. And we're told in verse 5 that there was a Jew in Susa the citadel whose name was Mordecai. I want you to see who he is. He, we're told, his lineage was a son of Kish, a Benjaminite. Remember that interesting note. So now Mordecai has some type of position, it seems, in the government for him to be here in the royal palace. And we are told that he's part of those, in verse 6, that were taken away as captives. He's part of the exiled, along with men like Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And so, even though Ahasuerus' grandfather was Cyrus, who let the Jews go back under Ezra, there were still Jews who remained in Babylon and other places in the empire. And so Mordecai is there, and we are told that he has a cousin that he had raised, a woman named Hadassah, that's her Hebrew name, that is Esther, which would be the name she was given in the foreign land, just like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now, Hadassah means myrtle, is what that name means. And we're told that she was a young woman who had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. And when her father and mother died, meaning she had become an orphan, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. And so you continue to read on, and they begin this kind of pageant here, and they begin to observe. The Jewish historian Josephus said that it came down to 400 chosen virgins. And out of that group would be where the new queen would come from. And Esther is one of those. And so in verse 12, it says that they began 12 months, a whole year of being prepped and beautified to go before the king. It says that 6 months they were getting beautified with myrrh and spices and ointments, and also she would be taught etiquette, how to go and present yourself before the king, how to conduct yourself, how to speak, and all of that. Because you're going to get one shot before him. And whether he likes you or not will decide whether you continue on or if you're the one that is chosen. And so, in verse 16, when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace, it says then in verse 17, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Now, think about it for a minute. If there were 400 women, and here's the king, they had to have all begun to just kind of look the same and just all been a blur. There's something different about Esther. There's something that stood out. And I don't believe it was just from a physical standpoint, but from who she was. And notice it says that as soon as the king saw her, he loved her more than all, and she won grace and favor in his sight, and she is crowned queen. Hey, she's a Jewish orphan. She's part of a conquered, exiled people, and now she has been elevated and brought to sit next to the king over the whole Persian empire. But there's one thing that the king doesn't know about her. He doesn't know that she's a Jew. Back up there in verse number 10, Mordecai had told her not to reveal who she was as far as her people. And that should not surprise us. When we think about in Ezra and in our study before in the book of Nehemiah, we have seen that there was anti-Jewish feeling that was very strong among different parts of the Persian Empire. And so she doesn't tell the king that. And so she's brought in. So we're introduced here to Mordecai and Esther. And Esther has now been made queen, but I want you to see the third scene. And that is Mordecai's nobility. Look at verse 19 now in chapter 2. It says, "Now when the virgins were gathered together the second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Esther had not made known her kindred or her people as Mordecai had commanded her, for Esther obeyed Mordecai just as when she was brought up by him. In those days, as Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus." That means kill him. So they're plotting an assassination attempt. And it says, "And this came to the knowledge of Mordecai, and he told it to Queen Esther. And Esther told the king in the name of Mordecai. When the affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were both hanged on the gallows, and it was recorded in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king." Note that. And so Mordecai, you didn't just, that term there, sitting at the king's gate, you didn't just, you weren't just there unless you had some type of position of service in the king's government. So he has some point or role that he played and that he served. He had a job in the king's palace. So he hears this plot. We're not told what they were mad about, but they were so angry with the king that they are ready to kill him. And Mordecai shows his nobility, shows his loyalty to the Persian king. He tells Esther, who better to tell than the queen. And she informs the king, and the matter is investigated. And these two men are found guilty, and they are executed. And the king witnesses that being put in the records. Historians tell us that one reason why we know so much about the Persians is because they were so animate in writing down everything that took place and their empire in official proceedings. But remember this nobility and this action of Mordecai. Now the fourth scene. And we meet, what better term? I don't know any better term to use than we meet the villain here of the book of Esther. And that is Haman. And I want you to notice here in chapter 3, Haman's plan. We're told in verse 1 that after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman the Agagite, advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. So this man has kind of got the role, it seems, almost of like a prime minister to the king. There's no one greater or higher than him in the government. But we notice something about him. In verse 2, and all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him, but Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" And when they had spoke to him day after day, and he would not listen to them, they told Haman, in order to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. And when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So, as they had made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. Now, Haman has devised a plan to where he will exterminate all of the Jews in the Persian kingdom. Why does he hate the Jews so much? Is it just because of Mordecai? Or is there something deeper? Now, I had never really paid attention or saw this until studying today. But go back to verse 1. And who is Haman? He's called the Agagite. And that is said several times in the book of Esther. That means that Haman is a descendant of the Amalekites. And remember that the Amalekites were descendants of Esau, themselves. And when Israel came out of Egypt, one of the first groups to attack them in Exodus 17 were the Amalekites. And you remember that's the battle where Moses up there on the rock, and when Moses had his arms up, Israel prevailed. And when they dropped, the Amalekites prevailed. And so Aaron came on one side and Hur came on the other, and they held Moses' arms up, and Joshua led the people to victory. Then when you get to Deuteronomy 25, verses 17 through 19, there's a curse that is pronounced upon the Amalekites, a curse to lead to extinction. And here, Haman is the Agagite. And that brings us back to 1 Samuel. If you remember, when Saul is king, that they went up against the Amalekites and he was commanded to kill all of them, including their king, Agag. So Haman is a descendant of the royal household of the Amalekites. And who is Mordecai? Mordecai, remember, is a Benjaminite. He had an ancestor named Kish. The same name, that same name for Saul's family. And so Haman knows his history. I remember last year, especially when a lot of the controversy was going on with the Syrian migration issue in the countries in Europe, places like Greece and the Baltic states did not want to let those migrants come in. I was talking with someone and I said, one of the things that we don't get here in America is because we have such a short span of time we've been a country, we don't have the years and years and years of history like countries in Europe, for example. All of those nations, for example, they heard stories and history classes about clashes with the Ottomans and all of that. Well, that's the same thing here with Haman. He knows the history. He knows about Saul and Israel and Haman's family, Agag and all that. Now, yes, it might have been 1,000 years from when the events in Exodus took place and centuries since Saul had killed the Amalekites, but Haman knew his history. And so that even makes it even more reason why he hates Mordecai. And not just Mordecai, but notice all of those of the nation of Israel. And so also because Mordecai is a Jew, he's not going to pay homage in that way like a pagan. And so all of this fills this man with hatred. And so we're told as you continue to move on that he, in verse 7, it says, month after month, he has some of those probably soothsayers and sorcerers casting lots to determine when would be the perfect time to execute this plan. And we're told that it comes into the time when Ahasuerus is in his 12th year. It's been 5 years since Esther was crowned queen. So he's been plotting and thinking about this for years, waiting for the right moment, according to the casting of the lots. And it lands, and verse 8, he comes to the king and says, there is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's law, so that it is not to the king's profit to tolerate them. If it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it into the king's treasury. So you eliminate this threat, and you take all their stuff. The spoils of conquering. King pleased him, takes his signet ring, gives it to Haman. King says in verse 11, the money is given to you. The people also do with them as it seems good to you. And in verse 13, it says, letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with instruction to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day. Now, this is not just the hatred of one man, but this is now a diabolic scheme. This is a scheme in the powers of darkness and of Satan to eliminate and annihilate the Jewish nation. And so, we move to chapter 4. And I want you to look at the fifth scene with me. And that is the petition given to the queen. It says in verse 1, when Mordecai learned all that had been done, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the midst of the city, and he cried out with a loud and bitter cry. He went up to the entrance of the king's gate, for no one was allowed to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. But it wasn't just Mordecai. In verse 3 it says, in every province, wherever the king's command, his decree reached, there was great mourning among the Jews with fasting and weeping and lamenting, and many of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. And so the people are pouring their hearts out to the Lord. When we read the term fasting there, you can be sure, even though the word is not used, that praying was taking place as well. Praying and fasting are never shown to be divided from one another in the scriptures. And so in verse 4, Esther's young women and her eunuchs came and told her. The queen was deeply distressed. She sent garments to clothe Mordecai, so that he might take off his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Now drop down to verse number 12. Mordecai has sent a message to Esther. And his message to Esther is this: you have to go to the king. Tell him who you are, and that the king's decree would put you and all of your people to death. Just one problem, though, with that request. You just couldn't go up to the king anytime you wanted to. The only time a person could come into the king's presence was when the king called for them to come. And for you to just go before the royal throne on your own initiative didn't just go against what was protocol, but it would probably mean you would be executed on the spot, because it would be seen that you might be trying to assassinate or harm the king without being called. And so that's what Esther tells her cousin: I can't do this. And so in verse 13, Mordecai replies, "Do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish." Now he's saying to her, Esther, they're going to find out eventually about you. And as we'll see later, and we remember back from our study of Daniel, that once a decree was made by the Persian king, it had to be fulfilled. And so it wouldn't matter whether she was a Jew or not. The order had to be carried out. She'd be executed. So Mordecai says it's not going to do you any good to be silent. And did you notice what he said, though, in verse 14? Now, out of all this happening, he's confident that there's going to be some of them spared. What's that tell us about Mordecai? It tells us that his dependence was upon a sovereign God whom he knew would be faithful to his covenant. His covenant with Abraham and with David. And so Mordecai said, there's going to be some of us, he said, from some other place, somewhere, there will be some who are spared because God keeps his word. But Esther, you'll die, and your father's house will perish. And then comes probably one of the most famous passages from this book. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Mordecai is saying, it may be that God in his providence and his sovereignty has put you there, Esther, for this time to be his instrument in bringing deliverance to his people. And so here comes the next famous part from this book. She replies to Mordecai, "Go gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf, and do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my young women," and those are her maidens, and they probably were Jewish associates of hers, most likely, "will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish." Now what we see here is there's a confidence in God's sovereignty, but these two individuals also knew they had to act as well. They had to be obedient, and they had to do something. So they weren't saying, we trust in God and be passive. We trust in God and we're going to be active. And she said here, if I die, I die. It's in God's hands. But I'm going to do what I believe he's calling me to do. And Mordecai goes away and does all that she has asked him to do. So in chapter 5, in verse 1, on the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace, in front of the king's quarters, while the king was sitting on his royal throne inside the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. And when the king saw Queen Esther standing in the court, she won favor in his sight, and he held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. So that meant that she could come. Is that a coincidence? No. That's the work of God. I don't know how long she waited. It must have seemed like years, but she made her way. And the king says in verse 3, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request?" Dr. MacArthur then called this next part royal hyperbole. "It shall be given you even to the half of my kingdom. Well, she didn't want that. In fact, she says in verse 4, here's what I'd like. For you and Haman to come today to a feast that I have prepared for the king. Then the king said, bring Haman quickly so that we may do as Esther has asked. And so they come. And in verse number 6, as they're drinking wine, he says, what is your wish? It shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even the half of my kingdom, it shall be fulfilled. Then Esther answered, my wish and my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it please the king to grant my wish and fulfill my request, let the king and Haman come to the feast that I will prepare for them, and tomorrow I will do as the king has said. Now, it seems that for some reason, she decided the first banquet was not the time to share all that was on her heart. So she decides to have another one. Well, verse number 9, Haman is just full of it. I mean, Haman already has an ego issue. He loves himself. I mean, everybody bows to him except one person, and that ruined his day. But now look at this. Not only has he been to one feast with the king and the queen, but she wants to have another one the next day. And so it says he is joyful, glad of heart, you know. But he sees Mordecai in the king's gate. And he neither rose nor trembled before him. He was filled with wrath against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home. And he sent and brought his friends, his wife Zeresh. And Haman recounted them the splendor. Now this is how you know he loves himself. He recounted them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions with which the king had honored him, and how he advanced him above the officials and the servants of the king. Well, it's been a very interesting time. Just listen to Haman brag on himself all the time. Then he said, even Queen Esther, let no one but me come with the king to the feast she prepared. And tomorrow also I am invited by her together with the king. Yet all this is worth nothing to me, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. Then his wife Zeresh and all of his friends said to him, make a gallows, and in the morning have Mordecai hanged upon it. And so he does so. He likes that idea. And so Haman believes that, you know, he has got all of this figured. He's going to get rid of the Jews because of what they've done to his people and all that. That animosity he's got. And he's going to get rid of Mordecai. He's going to have him executed. Here is Haman's hatred. And in chapter 6, while he's plotting and scheming and building what he believes will be the death place for Mordecai, we're told something else is taking place in the royal palace. Because on some reason, on that night in verse 1 of chapter 6, the king couldn't sleep. And he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. Now, I don't know why he wanted that to be read to him, except maybe he thought it would bore him to sleep, and he'd go to sleep after listening to all that. But something is said that catches his attention. It is said in verse 2, it was found written how Mordecai had told about Bithna and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold and who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So remember, back in chapter 2, remember when that plot was uncovered, it was recorded. And the king asked the question, what honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? The king's young men who attend him said, nothing has been done for him. Now, the king was a very smart man. If you have people like Mordecai who are looking out for you, you want to honor that type of person. And this type of culture, loyalty is prized and valued. And so if you had somebody who was a faithful servant like that, you want to honor and esteem them to keep them loyal to you. And also those who are disloyal, like those two men, you execute quickly and make an example of them. And so, the king in verse 4 says, who is in the court? And our friend Haman comes in. And Haman comes in and he is ready to have his request presented about Mordecai's execution. And so the king tells Haman to come in. And the king asks Haman a question before Haman can give his petition in verse 6. What should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor? Who do you think Haman thought he was talking about? Well, we're told he thought to himself, whom would the king delight to honor more than me? And so Haman replies in verse 7, for the man whom the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, and the horse that the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown is set. And let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. Let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor, and let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. I wonder how long Haman had ever thought about this. He sure had all that ready to go off the tip of his tongue. So he, remember, had went the night before and recounted all the promotions the king had given him, and yet he thought of one more that he thought was better. But I would have loved to have been there to have watched what must have been his hardest attempt to keep his composure when the king said, that's a great idea. Now I want you to go out and do all that for Mordecai. I want you to go out and you put my robe on him. And you know who's going to lead him? It's going to be you, Haman. You're going to be the one that leads the horse. And it will be Haman who has to say, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Well, verse 12, after all that took place, Mordecai returned to his post at the king's house. But Haman hurried to his house mourning, and with his head covered, we put it in our language today, he went home pouting, very upset. And Haman told his wife and his friends, he got the whole group back together, and his wise men, that's the magicians, and his wife said, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. They gave him the warning. They said, it's not looking good for you. So that brings us to the next scene. And that is saving the people. Esther pleads for her people. Well, chapter 7 takes us to the second banquet. Well, I don't know how long Haman cried and moped around, but he gets himself all decked out and ready. After all, the queen did want him to come, and only him. So maybe that lifted his spirits up some. And he gets there, and the king asks, as they're drinking wine, what is your wish, Queen Esther? Same thing, it shall be granted to you all the way up to half of my kingdom. And she says in verse 3, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be granted me for my wish and my people for my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. If we had been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have been silent. For our affliction is not to be compared with the loss to the king. Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther, who is he? And where is he who has dared to do this? Now remember, it's not just the two of them in there when all this is taking place. There's a third man. And Haman is hearing it all, and he had no idea. She was a Jew. And Esther said, a foe and enemy, this wicked Haman. And I suppose she probably pointed her finger right at him. Then Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. And the king arose in his wrath from the wine drinking and went into the palace garden. So I'm assuming that means he went outside to cool off because he is so infuriated. Remember, Haman's is kind of his right-hand man. And then Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther. For he saw that harm was determined against him by the king. And the king returned from the palace garden to the place where they were drinking wine. As Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was, and the king said, will he even assault the queen in my presence, in my own house? As the word left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face. So Haman was begging for his life, but the king took it as if Haman was trying to assault Esther. So he's taken out. He's executed. Where's he executed at? Verse 9 says, on the gallows that he prepared for Mordecai. And the king said, hang him on that. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the wrath of the king abated. Then you get in chapter 8 and chapter 9, you will read about what had to happen. Remember, when the king of Persia made a decree, he could not rescind it. So he had to issue a new decree that said to all of those Jews in the provinces that they had the right and the freedom by the king's order to defend themselves from anyone who tried to harm them or steal their property. And that is what chapter 8 and chapter 9 cover about that reaction by the Jews and that they defended themselves. And it says in chapter 9, and in verse 23, so the Jews accepted what they had started to do and what Mordecai had written to them. For Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to destroy them and had cast pur, that is, cast lots, to crush and destroy them. But when it came before the king, he gave orders in writing that his evil plan that he had devised against the Jews should return on his own head, and that he and his son should be hanged on the gallows. Therefore they called these days Purim, after the term pur. Therefore, because of all that was written in this letter, and of what they had faced in this matter, and of what had happened to them, the Jews firmly obligated themselves and their offspring and all who joined them, that without fail they would keep these 2 days according to what was written, and at the time appointed every year, that these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation, every clan, province, and city, and that these days of Purim should never fall into disuse among the Jews, nor should the commemoration of these days cease among their descendants. And they still do celebrate it as a ethnic people to this day. It, along with a Hanukkah, are two festivals that are instituted after, and they're not part of the Mosaic law. And then in chapter 10, Mordecai was elevated, and he takes a role similar to Joseph and Daniel. It says that Mordecai the Jew in verse 3 was second to rank to King Ahasuerus, and he was great among the Jews and popular with the multitude of his brothers, for he sought the welfare of his people and spoke peace to all his people. Now, brothers and sisters, the name God might not be in this book, but God's all over it. There's way too many coincidences to be occurring here. These acts didn't just all happen by chance. It was God who gave victory to the Greeks over the Persians that caused the king to go back home. It was God who brought Esther to his attention out of all of those women that he could have selected. And it was God using Esther in that position to bring about the deliverance of her people. And why is that important? Because, brothers and sisters, the book of Esther is a post-exilic book after the Babylonian exile. God had spared his people, brought them to Babylon, 70 years came, and then they were allowed to go back. But the threats to exterminate them still continued. Why? Because it was through that people that a Redeemer, that a Messiah would come. And for such a time as this would occur years later in Bethlehem, as Paul says in Galatians 4 and 4, and at the appointed time, Christ was born under the law to a virgin. And so God spared Esther and his people to fulfill his redemptive plan. And so what we see out of the book of Esther is that our God is a covenant-keeping God. And he said that he would indeed bring one that would sit upon the throne of David for all eternity. If they had been exterminated and annihilated here, that wouldn't have happened. But even in the midst of all that pressure, Mordecai believed that God would spare some of them because he's a covenant-keeping God. And that should encourage us tonight to know that God is still a covenant-keeping God. Jesus said in Matthew chapter number 16, the gates of hell shall not prevail against the church. Amen. And so he is ever with us, and he will ever protect us. And all that he does is for our good and for our glory. And so this evening, out of the book of Esther, we see God working and moving to preserve his people so that a Savior, Messiah, would come forth. And in our lives, we're here at this time, and we face a lot of pressures. We've seen a lot of changes take place, but we are called to be faithful and persevere because we have a covenant-keeping God who is ever with his people. Father, we thank you for this wonderful account of your faithfulness, your love for your people, for the courage of Esther and Mordecai. We thank you most of all that you kept them and preserved them so that Jesus Christ could be born in fulfillment to the prophecies, so that he could come and redeem a people made up of Jew and Gentile alike. Father God, I pray our hearts have been encouraged. I pray that we would remember who you are and that we can lean and trust in you each and every day. It's in Christ's name I do pray. Amen.